means something happened that could generate a tsunami, but the data is still being evaluated by the Tsunami Warning Center.
Conversations. My name is Holly Stark, and I am the Disaster Preparedness Outreach Program Manager at the Washington Emergency Management Division. I have my colleague, Ethan Weller, here with me, and he is a Tsunami Program Coordinator. I just wanted to thank the Washington Military Department for letting us come take over this podcast for a special observance, and that is National Preparedness Month. So National Preparedness Month is a federal emergency management agency, or FEMA-led initiative, and it focuses on the need to prepare for and mitigate against our hazards. And we have a lot here in Washington State and a lot around the world. And I've brought Ethan here with me today to talk about a special project that relates to the 2024 theme of National Preparedness Month, which is preparing our Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islanders. So Ethan, tell me about your project.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me. So for the past year and a half, I've been working on the tsunami deep dive portion of hazard simplification on behalf of the National Weather Service. So essentially the premise of the project is just based on years of social science research, found that some of the messaging, when we message hazard risk, it can often be confusing for the public. So they're undergoing an effort to simplify the wording in that. So my portion of that is because the tsunami hazard was not originally included in the social science research that they did. So I have been working with the other state and territory tsunami programs within the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program. And that's all of the state and territory emergency management and science agencies within each state and territory, in addition to some federal partners as well. So I've been supporting these state and territory tsunami programs evaluate the impacts of a potential alerting change on their program. So the first part of that project was supporting the documentation of their existing processes, procedures, and products as they relate to tsunami alerting and response. That was based off of a lot of the work that we did out here in Washington State after 2018. The next part of the project is utilizing that foundation that they created, evaluating the tsunami alerting and response in the throughout the duration of the tsunami threat, so the first 24 hours of a tsunami. And it's using that foundation to identify any existing gaps, needs, and challenges in alerting and communication that each state and territory has. Once we have those gaps, needs, and challenges from our state and territory partners, we're going to evaluate those, and then we're going to be able to identify specific projects within the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program to work on projects to fill those gaps little by little. Ultimately, we'll be able to create more resiliency for tsunamis in the states and territories and save some lives.
Excellent. And yeah, tsunami is one of those risks that's like really low probability, but high, high potential for hazard impact on our communities. And some of these territories that you've been working with have a lot of challenges, including some really remote areas. So tell me, what territories have you been working on?
So specifically, it's been American Samoa, Guam, the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, and Hawaii as well. And they are under the jurisdiction of, well, the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center is responsible for alerting for their coastlines. For those who might be more familiar with the West Coast out here, we do have the National Tsunami Warning Center up in Palmer, Alaska. So the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center has also been an important part of the project.
And before I move on, you touched a little bit on warning levels and different language that we use to warn people about tsunamis. Can you tell me what the warning levels are and what the idea behind removing some of them might have been?
Yeah. So currently, both tsunami warning centers have four different alert levels. So the lowest one is just an information statement, which means people might have felt an earthquake or the earthquake is all the way across the Pacific Ocean and there's not going to be a tsunami threat to our coastlines here. The next step up from that is that there's a tsunami watch. And so that means that a potential tsunami-genic occurrence has happened, which means something happened that could generate a tsunami, but the data is still being evaluated by the Tsunami Warning Center, and an update is on the way at some point. Above that is an advisory. So tsunami advisory is where we start to see some impacts. An advisory is associated with wave heights between 1 and 3 feet along some point of Washington's coastline. And typically we see from a tsunami advisory, we see a lot of maritime impacts. There might be a little bit of inundation or places on land that are dry, usually dry, that are now wet from the tsunami waves. But advisory is a bigger threat for the maritime community. Above that, we see tsunami warning, which is the big one, of course. So that's going to be wave heights of at least 3 feet. Just one caveat for this for our viewers as well is I just want to mention for Washington specifically, if you do receive an alert level, that is for the entire coastline of Washington here. So, with a tsunami warning, you can see more significant flooding on land, higher waves, and it will have a greater impact than an advisory would.
Yeah, so you can see why that'd be really important to get really clear language about that for all of our states and territories, because we talk constantly about the need to get alerts. And if you don't understand what those alert means, you might not take the right protective action. So that's a really important project. Why is it so important to the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program that you tackle this?
This position is pretty unique within the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program. This is a really good opportunity for states and territories to share information outside of our usual biannual meetings and the subcommittees that we have within the National Tsunami Hazard Mitigation Program as well. Additionally, since I am working with some specific territory emergency management offices as part of this project, this allows them the opportunity to take a deeper dive into their tsunami alerting and response procedures, see where they're at, and then once they know that, they are able to provide some input to their federal partners and then create a foundational document that they can use for planning purposes moving forward. On the flip side of that, from more of the federal NTHMP level, once we're able to gather all of these gaps, needs, and challenges that we're documenting as part of this project, I mentioned this a little bit before, but we're going to be able to work on some specific projects to tackle those gaps at a national scale. And so that way, it's not just, you know, the West Coast or some specific states that are really getting the benefit of these projects, but it's the input from all states and territories that are being incorporated into this. And so a big part of that also, the reason why the timing is really crucial here as well is because the tsunami warning centers are currently undergoing some upgrades to better align their procedures with each other and then be able to better support each other in an event. So having that input from all of the customers they serve at the state and territory level is essential.
Perfect. And what have you discovered about preparedness and mitigation as you've worked on these timelines and this documentation that, like, you know, in emergency management, we always say, if you didn't document it, it didn't happen. So it's great to have those foundational things in place. What have you learned from that?
So a lot of this, for me, especially coming into this job, is this was my first career job out of grad school, just the contextual background of all the states and territories and the different risks that they face. And so what do I mean by that? So taking a look at Guam, they have about 170,000 people, which would be the fifth largest city here in Washington. But that's not the only context that's important, right? So they're an island. So while we have to worry about tsunamis on our West Coast and our inner waterways and our 3,000 miles of coastline that we have here in Washington, going out to an island and they're fully encircled by potential tsunami impacts. So the context of the tsunami risk itself has been eye-opening, to say the least. Beyond that, in terms of preparedness and mitigation specifically, There are a lot of similarities, especially when considering mitigation. So some basic mitigation that some ports and harbors can go through to strengthen their infrastructure and lessen the impacts of a tsunami is they can raise their pilings or they can replace their cleats on their docks. And that's just not applicable for Washington. That's applicable to anywhere in the Pacific that has a tsunami risk that can help protect from those impacts. On the preparedness side, it is similar. There's similar ideas behind it. But what really is highlighted from the territories themselves is how they build preparedness into their culture. So What does it mean for all of the cultural groups that they have on their islands? How are they taking that with all of the different languages that are spoken on their island? How are they messaging that? How are they getting people to learn about the hazards that they need to know about and then take action to protect themselves from it?
Yeah, that's such a great point. I had the opportunity to live and work on Hawaii for a while, and we had 22 threshold languages that people needed preparedness information in. And they are really, you know, in the event of a big hurricane or a tsunami, very stranded. So they the way they prepare and go to the store and get the things that they need to build a 2 weeks ready kit is very different than us, where we would have some outside resources available to us a lot quicker than Hawaii or Guam or any of those islands would have.
Exactly.
So speaking of, what other challenges do these communities face when we're talking about tsunamis or other natural hazards?
So I'll give a couple examples here. So one of the big ones that I learned of recently was just regarding their sirens. So installing and maintaining their siren networks that they have. So for here in Washington, we have 122 tsunami sirens along our coast, and we have someone here to maintain them. It's easy for us to just drive out to the coast and we can do some easy maintenance on it. But when looking at some of these islands, even just ordering the equipment and getting it out within their jurisdictions, that can be somewhere up in the tens of thousands of dollars. Beyond that, once you have the equipment, you might have to find a boat that can carry the equipment out to another island. And then do you have the right parts to install it on that island? So there's a lot of challenges just logistically from being able to provide their emergency management services to the public on different islands. A lot of these islands rely very heavily on their maritime infrastructure for their economy. American Samoa has nearly 90% of their exports flow out of their harbors. If you're a fan of Starkist tuna, then you probably get it from American Samoa. So that is a significant part of their economy coming from the infrastructure that is heavily impacted by tsunamis themselves, which is a tremendous challenge. Beyond that, even just having when a tsunami happens, you rely on other agencies to fulfill certain tasks. So, but in American Samoa, in Guam and CNMI, places that are several thousand miles away from the U.S. West Coast, there's not any federal agencies that have actual property on those islands. So it's how do we fulfill those responsibilities that the other agencies have? And even if it's a delay in timing, there's just additional challenges on top of that logistically, even after a tsunami happens. So,
yeah, absolutely. So our work primarily focuses on the preparedness and mitigation side. But when we think about the recovery efforts that it would take to respond and then get a community back up and running that's so vulnerable to tsunami out there and alone in the ocean, it's pretty crazy to think about. And so we need to really, this work is so important. But as it relates to home, how have you noticed this project informing what we do here in Washington?
Yeah, so we've been able to get some good value out of this project as well. So a lot of that, I mentioned earlier that we have gotten, or a lot of the work that we did to understand our tsunami alerting procedures and processes here in Washington was done after 2018, when there was an earthquake up in Alaska. And we wanted to take a deeper look at how that impacted our alert levels compared to our neighbors. So beyond that, in our conversations that we've had with the other territories, we've been able to verify some of the work that we've done, but also we've been able to compare what is similar, what is different for your tsunami program versus ours, and then dig into a little bit deeper about why that difference exists. Is it something that just the software isn't available, or is it that they work specifically with someone like the National Weather Service to develop these special procedures that we can get some value out of? So it's really been good to have better discussions with our partners from what we're learning in our work with other states and territories to deepen those relationships and deepen our understanding of tsunami alerting and response.
Yeah, I love what you said about partners and relationships and those connections that we develop with people who are in this sphere working on it. It feels like a global community tackling this amazing challenge. As part of our work at the Washington Emergency Management Division, we have an actual mandate from the state legislature to address resilience. And that's defined in code as the ability to prepare, mitigate, plan for, withstand, recover from, and more successfully adapt to adverse events and changing conditions. And then this is the part I love, and reorganize in an equitable manner that results in a new and better condition. That's a lot. That's a huge mandate. But the equitable part is really important to me. So how is this project working to address equitable resilience?
Good question. So as we know, risk is everywhere. Another fact is that just disasters don't discriminate. It's just a matter of fact of where you live. So we know that there is tsunami risk across the entire Pacific Ocean. So whether you are in American Samoa, whether you are in Guam, whether you're in Washington, there are sources all around the Pacific Basin, and tsunami is going to be a hazard that your community faces. So being able to support the state and territories throughout this project, it's ensuring that they have a voice, that they have a say. As I mentioned, the Tsunami Warning Center are going through some upgrades right now. And so as a critical partner who received their products, being able to give them some feedback and have a voice in that process is just tremendously important. And the territories themselves, they're an important part of our nation. So being able to ensure that their voices are heard through projects like this is just one way that we can ensure that the work we do has the greatest impact for the greatest amount of people.
Perfect. I love what you said just there. I've been questioning a lot because FEMA chooses these different themes, and we've touched on our Hispanic communities before. Last year, it was preparing for our older adults, and this year, of course, Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islanders. And is that equitable to single out a different community? And I think my answer is exactly what you said, is giving everybody a voice at the table. Everybody needs to be prepared and mitigate, but we don't all do it the same. And so having these opportunities to focus on these communities helps us prepare in their languages or with their unique cultural background, but everybody still gets prepared. And I love that. Okay, so moving on to preparedness, this is kind of the fun little part, but what is your favorite preparedness tip?
So as a big foodie, I was worried when I was going through grad school in emergency management, you know, they're like, keep supplies on hand. And in my head, I'm like, oh, that's canned food. You know, that's stuff that I typically don't eat. Canned corn, canned peas, you know, not stuff that's necessarily the most appetizing for me. So as soon as I came here and having conversations within our team and people around us, as soon as I found out that chocolate was a great thing to keep in your emergency kit, that is something that I will latch on to. And I want to make sure that everybody knows is that put chocolate in your emergency kit. Since you should be checking on emergency supplies every 6 months, put a chocolate bar in there. It's an excuse to go eat that chocolate and get some new chocolate. So, definitely on the food side of things, I just want to say put food in your emergency kit that you want to eat, that you enjoy eating. It doesn't just have to be canned goods that'll get you through, but chili, chocolates, whatever your heart desires, as long as it can store well, then put it in there.
Absolutely agree. Something that makes you feel a little bit more comfortable and something that is sure to make you feel uncomfortable. These natural hazards can have big impacts on our community. And if you're there with your family, eating a bar of chocolate, it might help you get through it a little bit. To that end, I always say put a comfort item in. I started my career as a writer and I used to write camping blogs. And I always said the same thing about camping as I do about emergency preparedness. Put something in there that makes you feel comfortable, that gives you that sense of normalcy. And that's one of my favorite preparedness tips. So why to you is it important to observe National Preparedness Month? And what is one takeaway you would like our listeners to come away with, either in general or as it relates to your project?
Yeah. So we live in a beautiful state. Washington's a beautiful state year round. But along with that, there are a lot of hazards that we face. So we have 5 active volcanoes. We have earthquakes. You know, I'm going to mention tsunamis, but also some more frequent hazards. Wildfires have been big recently. Flooding and even human caused hazards like hazardous materials, something like that. There are a lot of hazards that we can face in our state. And so National Preparedness Month is just an opportunity to open up your plans again, relearn your hazards, revisit your emergency preparedness. So are there hazards that you might not have considered before that maybe a state agency knows a little bit more about? Or perhaps, you know your hazards, but it's been a while since you went through like an emergency communications plan with your family, or it's been a while since you've looked at your emergency kits. So, the National Preparedness Month is just a great opportunity to do that. And we do recommend having go bags for work in your car at home with 3 days worth of supplies, and then a full 2 weeks of emergency supplies at your home for your entire family, pets included. I just want to put that in there as well. As far as one takeaway also, I think that I'll give a general shout out to our locals that are working hard out there. So throughout the summer, if you're just not sure where to start with your preparedness or not even sure about what hazards you face, a lot of communities will hold preparedness, safety fairs, similar names like that, in which your local emergency management, police and fire officers will show up. And it's a great time to have a conversation, meet your local emergency managers, ask what they're doing. Why not? And then beyond that, you'll just be able to gather some resources, maybe learn a thing or two. Even I will just say that our team is able to be out there and support sometimes. So if you see us out there, definitely stop by and say hello. There are a few more preparedness or safety fairs happening throughout National Preparedness Month this September, and I think a couple maybe into October. Yeah. So see what's around you. If you want more information, you want to have a conversation, we're big nerds about our hazards, so definitely come and chat with us. We're happy to talk. And bonus is that you could always most likely, I'm not going to say for sure, though, most likely get some free items that you can put in your emergency kit.
Yeah, if nothing else, at least a really good list to get you started. I would probably add to that, my one last thing is that I've been trying to push really hard that it's going to take all of us working together to survive any natural disaster that is going to be big scale. And so use this opportunity to get to know your neighbors. Try to get to know your Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islanders. We have so many wonderful resources that they bring to our communities. And then, you know, learn how you can help them and how they can help you. And just resilience is the only way we can do it is together. And then the last thing, we're so excited. We'll be sharing tips all month. We'll have blogs out. We'll have this podcast. And if you want to learn more about your hazards or how to sign up for local alerts, which we've touched on, how to get preparedness tips, or watch any of the videos that we've created, please visit us at www.mil.wa.gov/preparedness. That's www.mil.wa.gov/preparedness. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Ethan, so much.
Thank you.